What do you see on the horizon? Uncertainty or opportunity? Whatever you see, at PGIM, we can help you rise to the challenges of today, providing outlooks on the market with deep global and local expertise. With over 1,400 investment professionals in pursuit of long-term returns, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Joe Weisenthal.
And I'm Tracy Alloway.
Tracy, you know how sometimes, I don't know if it's a joke, but we'll, at the end of an episode, we'll be like, well, we're going to have to check back a year from now to see how that developed.
It's not meant to be a joke. It's meant to be.
It's not a joke, but I don't know if we always do it or if we really always, you know, follow up on those, but it is something we say.
All right. But we're making good on one of those comments now, though, right?
We are doing an episode that I think can legitimately be said to be a follow-up. You know, I think it was obviously like basically a year ago around this time that we first sort of became aware of the coronavirus. We didn't know how big of a deal it was going to be. We didn't know how, you know, we knew it was sort of bubbling up. We knew that there were cases in Wuhan. We didn't know much, though, about the overall impact. And you know, one of the first people that we discussed it with was with our guest today.
Right. So this particular guest has been on a few times now, and we always get requests for him to come back. Last year, when we spoke to him, it was February, as you mentioned, the coronavirus crisis was just really getting underway, but we'd already seen a bunch of supply chain disruptions, and there was a lot of talk at the time about what that might mean for tech specifically. So in tech, you have these really complicated supply chains with lots of little components, particularly semiconductors. So we did, we had a big conversation about that at the time. And now we can check in and see what's actually happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's useful. I think your framing there is really good because at the time, we didn't know yet that it was going to be this global health crisis.
Right.
We were really, at the time, we were focused on, well, what does this mean for Chinese manufacturing? Because we knew that a lot of factories were shut down, including the suppliers. One of the first companies in the U.S. to really warn that they were seeing an impact from the virus was Apple, which talked about disruption to its suppliers and the attendant disruption that would happen with its product rollout. So even, you know, in the very early days, that still seemed like the angle. Tech and manufacturing. And then, of course, it was just a few weeks later that we realized we were looking at a full-blown global health crisis.
Right. And now, of course, this is a little bit outside of tech, but now a year later, China's economy is actually doing a lot better on a number of measures versus places like the US or perhaps Europe. It continues to develop its tech industry, of course, and we know the government has really doubled down on its attempts to create or improve its domestic tech capabilities. And if anything, I guess the tensions with the U.S. over trade, plus the supply chain disruptions from COVID, has really encouraged the leadership in China to look at this and to accelerate this idea of tech independence.
Yep. So an extraordinary year just sort of on all fronts. As you mentioned, our guest is a recurring Odd Lots guest, always one of the most requested. So I'm very excited to have him back. We're going to be speaking with Dan Wong. He is a technology analyst at Gavcal, Dragonomics. He knows a lot about a lot of stuff, particularly related to tech and manufacturing, and can speak about it in a way that very few people can. So, Dan, thank you very much for coming back on the show.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Joe and Tracy.
I mean, there's so much to discuss over the last year and so many different things. And of course, you know, we've been talking a lot about chips on the show and we've been, you know, everything. But so starting big picture, I mean, we last talked to you about a year ago. You know, what have you learned about China and its manufacturing and business capabilities watching it deal with the crisis over the last year?
First, I learned that China is a lot more brutal than I thought, and already from a pretty high level of efficiency as well as ruthlessness. And second, I thought that China is now the most can-do society in the world just by how quickly it mobilized to really try to contain this pandemic and to really try to restart production. And let me talk through both aspects of that. Now, I lived in Beijing through the very worst of the pandemic. I was in Beijing starting from early February, and it was a pretty much a ghost town at that time. A lot of restaurants had been closed. A lot of workers, a lot of people who left Beijing back home had not been able to make it back to Beijing for about a few weeks to an entire month. And the city was mostly locked down. I had a person posted outside my apartment checking for apartment passes to make sure that people can come in and out. There was basically universal mask wearing, and there still almost is universal mask wearing about 12 months after the start of the pandemic. I had to bring a health code app, which is embedded into my smartphone everywhere that I went. And it was very difficult to travel within China. And for a lot of foreigners people outside of China, it was very, very difficult for them to come back. And this is to say nothing of the centralized quarantine system that China implemented to separate sick people away from families so that they don't transmit through an entire household, which basically was a very ruthless affair. Now, if you take a look and at the Chinese COVID numbers, there's always a lot of questions about Chinese data. Officially, the country has reported something like 80,000 cases. And even if you want to expand that by an order of magnitude, which, you know, maybe is something that I can accept, the trend of the data has shown that COVID was pretty much conclusively stomped out in the country by April, which lines up very well with our experiences. That's when the lockdowns peaked and life slowly started to get back to normal, even though there have been a few flare-ups here and there. And by September, I remember this very vividly when I spent a month in Shanghai, which had been much more relaxed than Beijing. I was sitting shoulder to shoulder with folks in the cinema. All the smart restaurants had been very difficult to book again. The strangest thing was that people were reaching out to shake my hand. And I found that kind of a very bizarre and gross experience. And it was very strange for me to think that, you know, a culture that did not invent handshaking is now sort of the only place really perpetuating this tradition. But, you know, this is that's a sign that life had been basically normal through a period of, pretty intense pain for a couple of months. Now, the second part of, life in China is that, you know, I saw how quickly China responded to really try to contain this a pandemic. In particular, I'll just highlight that manufacturers are really sprang into action to try to contain this pandemic. I know that Bloomberg put out an article today showing that China exported something like 240 billion masks last year, which is something like 40 masks per person in the world, because its production facilities were just able to get up and running really quickly. Now, one of the things I heard from a manufacturer in China is that, you know, when they take a look at their counterparts in the U.S., so many of them had to ask if making masks is part of their core competence, whereas the Chinese company simply decided that making money is their core competence, and therefore they should go make masks. And therefore, every part of the supply chain really sprang up. A lot of the consumer internet apps changed their user interfaces to accommodate COVID tracking, for example, to make it very easy to find a fever clinic or a hospital nearby. And China mobilized really, really quickly and very intensely to deal with this big threat in a way that hasn't necessarily replicated in a lot of parts of the West.
I have what might be a strange question based on that, but how much of this can you attribute to the can-do spirit of Chinese society, as you put it, versus the benefits of having a command economy with a centralized authority that can instruct people to do things like, you know, post attendance outside of buildings and make sure that people aren't breaking lockdown, and they can tell factories to start manufacturing masks and things like that? I guess I'm asking, how much of it is spontaneous adaptation versus centralized directives?
I think it is both. I think it is neither entirely one, and obviously not entirely the other. I think that it is both the case that a lot of Chinese folks, first of all, were very careful in complying with government orders, and then second of all, in figuring out what they can do as part of this pandemic. If it were entirely a command economy, you know, the Soviet style, this goes there, I don't think it could have been quite as effective as a lot of Chinese manufacturers just being very nimble, retooling their products, and then figuring out how to get production back online again.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that what you said, companies identifying their core competence as making money is sort of an interesting way to frame it. Can you expand on that a little bit more and what that process was like? I mean, there obviously, you know, must have been many factories, many companies that had never made PPE equipment prior to the spring or prior to last winter, who suddenly got very good at it. And how did they do it?
Well, you know, I hasten to add a caveat here that many of them were not necessarily very good at it. And a lot of Chinese masks turned out to be defective early on. Now, a lot of these were either culled by regulatory action, or they just learned and figured out very quickly how to make better masks and were able to export quite so many around the world. And I think the issue here is that, you know, one of the issues with manufacturing in the U.S. early on in the pandemic had been that the U.S. government did not send out these very clear profit signals that we need PPE, that we will pay for all of this stuff. And the Chinese government, first of all, established a lot of these clear pricing incentives in these regulated healthcare areas, as well as pretty much making mask wearing mandatory, as well as, you know, sort of frightening people enough into believing that this is indeed a very serious virus that everybody needs to take seriously. And so once you had all of these things in place, and you also had, you know, a lot of sympathy for the victims of Wuhan early on, people felt that, well, maybe we need to help out. And a lot of companies reacted in a good way to try to contain this pandemic.
So does that adaptation or that ability to evolve your business model very quickly to adapt to new situations, does that extend to more complicated manufacturing, things like technology? So we've had you on a bunch of times before, as Joe and I have both mentioned, and we've talked about some of the headwinds facing China when it comes to developing its own tech base, specifically in semiconductors. In 2020, we saw new challenges to China's ambitions emerge. So we had COVID-19 messing with the supply chains, and we also had the U.S. basically doubling down on its trade war with China and issuing a whole bunch of new orders that are interfering with Chinese tech in some way. How easy is it for China to adapt to that new situation?
Very good question, Tracy. And I'm not sure if it is that easy at all. I'm not sure that these, you know, the ability to mobilize a lot during a pandemic necessarily translates into, you know, making China a scientific superpower. In this case, you know, I think the one clear area where the U.S. really distinguished itself was through its scientific establishment of getting together these mRNA vaccines that have a really superb efficacy out in a very quick speed. Now, the rest of the U.S. supply chain hasn't necessarily reacted very well. Distribution now doesn't look like a great success yet. But this is where the U.S. Did very well. Whereas in China, you know, I think the scientific establishment, you know, outside of the pandemic in general, has never really been very well established. China has not, after years of trying very hard, become a leader in something like semiconductors. It has not become a leader in aviation. radiation. And there are a whole bunch of, you know, scientific knowledge that I'm not sure that a lot of, folks here really possess in a very big way. But I think it is worth bringing up, as you did, Tracy, that the U.S. doubled down on this trade war over 2020, which, was accelerated in some part by a negative perception of China in the U.S. And having spoken about a list of China's failures in the past, I think one of the points that I've been making much more frequently now is that this time is different for Chinese industrial policy. And this time is different for Chinese industrial policy because of U.S. Actions. Now, if you consider the broader history of Chinese industrial policy over the last few years, to say nothing of the last few decades, when China put out its first five-year plan in 1959, I would say that the broad mass of Chinese industrial policy has mostly been a failure. Now, you can point to some successes in something like solar panels and something like high-speed rail in certain segments of heavy industries. For the most part, for bigger ticket items, Chinese firms have not been highly distinguished in segments like semiconductors or in aviation. And I think the fundamental problem with Chinese industrial policy in the past has been that the Chinese government was forcing basically government ministries and state-owned firms to buy obviously inferior Chinese technologies and then hope that basically the scale of the buying as well as interprovincial competition can drive a lot of innovation and a lot of high quality and products. Now, sometimes that works in the case of high-speed rail, and also there's a lot of different things that don't work. And what's happened after the 4 years of the Trump administration, the Trump administration has really targeted a lot of China's technology leaders, leading firms, most of them private, for some form of sanctions. For example, it has really put the screws on Huawei, which I think is China's most important technology company, and you may have a debate about whether it's private or not. The Trump administration has imposed a form of sanction on Tencent, as well as on ByteDance, which owns respectively WeChat, as well as TikTok. It's designated China's leading semiconductor maker, SMIC, to the entity list. Really, the only Chinese major technology company that hasn't faced some form of sanctions has been Alibaba. But in this case, actually, it is Beijing that's stepped up to the plate to put the screws on Alibaba. I think the issue here is that the U.S. government has entirely aligned the incentives of Chinese firms with that of the state, which has always tried to pursue self-sufficiency as technological greatness. In the past, these Chinese companies have not always tried to sign on to a lot of these their agendas. If you take a look, Alibaba and Tencent and Huawei have always been using very substantial amounts of U.S. technologies because they've always been the best in class. But now they have a great incentive to try to build up the technological ecosystem in China. And to editorialize a little bit here, I think the U.S. reacted to the technological rise of the USSR and Japan mostly by trying to invest more in itself and building up more of its own industries. And it's reacting to the technological rise of China mostly by trying to kneecap China's leading firms. So instead of realizing its own Sputnik moment, it's really triggering one in China. And just to extend the space analogy just a little bit further, I think the U.S. government has put Huawei into the position that NASA was in the 1960s when it was the main buyer for semiconductors, and it was buying chips only on the basis of performance, not cost. And so Huawei now is a very cash-rich, very competent firm that is trying to get its hands on Chinese semiconductors just so long as they work without spending too much time thinking about, whether this is a long-term company or not, simply because it really wants to build up more of a reliable ecosystem.
That's fascinating. Is there some reason why that one can point to talk about the success China has had in solar and high-speed rail that hasn't translated into semiconductors and aviation in terms of what it was about industrial policy or demand-side policies that made those areas different?
Well, Joe, a lot of the academics who've studied this exact question have sort of come to the conclusion that it's really hard to find patterns here. When you take a look at Chinese policies in things that include, the electrical grid and things that include, solar panels and high-speed rail, which are relative successes, and in semiconductors and aviations, where they've been failures, it's been a lot of the same policies, including a lot of the same people. So it's really difficult to figure out, exactly what's going on here. You can can, you know, spin out a wonderful story in every particular case. Maybe there is just some complexity criterion, which I completely believe in, taking a look at how complex the semiconductor supply chain is. But it's very difficult to find easy answers here.
What do you see on the horizon for financial markets? From uncertainty to opportunity, PGIM can help you rise to the challenges of today when disciplined risk management is needed most. With $1.2 trillion in AUM and deep expertise across asset classes, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Dan, I wanted to go back to something you said. You highlighted this irony. It's a pretty big irony that almost all the major tech companies in China have had some sort of U.S. restriction imposed on them in recent years, except for Alibaba. But of course, now Beijing has basically done the U.S.'s job for it and imposed a bunch of limitations on the business. There's some reports of Jack Ma having gone missing. People aren't really sure what's going on with him. Is that another headwind for Chinese tech, or would you imagine that that would have a sort of cooling effect on entrepreneurs?
Well, certainly the equity market has believed so. I believe Alibaba has at this point lost around 25% of its value throughout the year as it's been continuously beaten up by the Chinese government, whereas Tencent has lost around 10% of its value. Now, whether this has a substantial cooling effect on entrepreneurs, well, you know, a lot of the Beijing line is that we need to create effective antitrust. This antitrust debate is happening very substantially also in Europe as well as in the US. We need to regulate a marketplace that makes life easier for a lot of smaller businesses. There's a lot of these financial issues that we're concerned about, these financial risks with Ant Financial. The difficulty for us is to, sort of disentangle that with an obviously impolitic speech that Jack Ma gave. And so, there's probably both a component of effective regulatory response to, more complex and more domineering private firms, as well as this personal issue. So it's pretty difficult to disentangle these things. Now, to answer your question a little bit more directly, what I would generally say is that Chinese state has generally been pretty well aware that its private sector has been much more dynamic than this, stodgy, moribund state sector. And it has not shown a huge amount of interest yet in really trying to stifle out basically a lot of entrepreneurial activity. Now, the Xi regime has been continuously more repressive, and it has signaled that there are certain things that it will control very strictly. But for the most part, I would not say that we're in this part of the world where China is completely ready now to force the entrepreneurs to be state actors. I think we're not quite there yet.
I want to get in, we've obviously been talking a lot about semis on the show, and I want to sort of get to that specifically soon and the state of the art of Chinese semiconductor manufacturing. But before we do, I think one of our recent guests talked about chips as sort of this, obviously incredibly complicated, extremely expensive marriage of chemistry and physics. And so before we talk about that, I want to get into the point you made about there's still like the limits of Chinese, the scientific community or the leading edge of science in China. And you mentioned the U.S. edge, the clear edge that the U.S. has had even throughout all this in making vaccines, which, of course, is, indicative of the strong U.S. science position. What are your observations? What do you perceive as academic observations about what it takes and what it will need for that to really grow and become cutting edge in China?
Well, the first thing I would like to do is to, I'm always trying to beat up on the consumer internet sector because I'm not sure how much of that is real technology. So many of the consumer internet names that we're all familiar with, including in China, especially Alibaba and Tencent, seem more to me to be companies that are really exploiting network effects, that are innovating on business models that are not necessarily creating a great deal of IP. Now, if you take a look at the broader scientific establishment in China, basically, you know, according to the government's own data, around about 5 to 10% of all of its R&D spending is going towards fundamental scientific research, which is around, as a share, about, I think, less than a half or about a third of US levels. So it's a completely different scale, a ballpark here. I'm not sure how much Chinese firms are really doing substantial amounts of very cutting-edge technology. According to some of the academic studies I've seen, basically the only area where Chinese scientists are publishing the majority of the top 1% of scientifically cited papers is in material sciences, where China has always taken a keen interest because it feeds into things like semiconductors as well as aviation. But what Chinese researchers do have, universities would tell me, is that they have a substantial amount of money being thrown at them basically to do work. Whereas when I talk to American researchers, what they would tell me is that, well, look, we're spending all of our time filling grants. We are spending all of our time preparing very detailed proposals to the National Science Foundation, which is pretty conservative and only funds very well-established researchers. So, structurally, one of the advantages that China would have, if you had to push me to say, is that, well, it sort of showers money a little bit randomly, but top scientists don't really have to keep wondering about whether this a committee of bureaucrats is going to approve their scientific project.
So just on that note, one of the themes that keeps coming out of our discussions on the semiconductor industry specifically is just the amount of money it takes to build those factories. It takes a lot of expertise as well, so you can't just throw money at the problem, obviously. But when the cost of building a new foundry is something like $10 billion, clearly you need some sort of capital at hand. And in certain places, the government has really encouraged that domestic industry to build up by investing, subsidizing it in some way. How has China approached the semiconductor industry, and what are the sort of avenues it can pursue in order to boost domestic capacity?
Mostly in the only way that the Chinese government knows how, which is by shoveling a lot of subsidy funds towards state-owned companies. That's usually been the story that China wants in order to have success. And, you're right that semiconductors now are incredibly capital intensive. I saw, today in the day of recording, TSMC has just released its latest quarterly results. It's committing something like $27 billion within this year to basically do more CapEx, which I think is just an astonishing figure, for a single company to commit over the course of 1 year. And so, the Chinese industry has never really been able to match that. And I think the Chinese government funds have never really been able to push these companies to be very competitive. They are still very reliant on subsidies in order to have more production.
So we talk about the Chinese semiconductor industry not being top flight yet. What is the state of it? What does it look like? How many important companies are there to watch? How advanced are they? How many years behind? Like, give us sort of just your assessment of where things stand right now relative to the rest of the world.
Well, if you really had to push me to give a single metric, this would broadly be unfair to the industry, but I would say, broadly speaking, I would say that Chinese firms are at the very least 5 years behind the cutting edge, if not something like closer to 15, if you take a look at certain segments. Now, my assessment in general of the Chinese semiconductor industry is that China's figured out sort of the basics of competing in pretty much every segment of the semiconductor value chain, but it is leading in none of them. Where it is close to being the market leader is something like assembly and packaging, which is pretty low value. It's relatively labor intensive. There are some successes like Huawei, which designs its own phone processors, just as Apple does. It is putting out some really cutting edge processors. There are a lot of Chinese design firms now that are designing pretty capable chips, as best as I can tell. But if you take a look at the actual manufacturing of chips, China's leading semiconductor maker has always persistently been about 5 years behind TSMC. And this is before it was sanctioned earlier last month onto the Commerce Department's entity list. And if you take a look basically at all of the inputs that China needs to make semiconductors, you know, some of the chemicals it can do, maybe some of the wafers it can do, but where it is very substantially behind is in something called EDA tools, which is the software that you need to actually design a semiconductor, as well as the actual manufacturing equipment. So the lithography machines, basically a lot of the testing machines, China is pretty much nowhere in a lot of these different segments. So China has managed to be very far behind Western as well as Japanese, Taiwanese, Korean firms, even when it had access to leading tools. Now, when the U.S. government has been much more active with sanctions, it's going to be much more difficult for them to stay, you know, even competitive at this point, because they have to wait for the rest of the ecosystem to catch up to basic competence, which is not quite there yet.
So a lot of your writing in 2020 sort of focused on the dynamic between performance and cost when it comes to technology and how companies and governments might treat that. Can you dive into that thesis for us? Because I think it explains a lot of what's going on in semiconductors at the moment.
So if you take a look at a lot of the early products of the technology industry, you know, a lot of early things simply don't work. So, you know, the first ever iPhone, people would say at this point, was barely functional as a phone. If you take a look at the earlier semiconductors, you know, the early integrated circuits, they had basically higher failure rates than older technology, transistor based. But what actually matters is that you need to continue investing in these new technologies. If you have a bigger market to address, then you have more money to plow into R&D. And a lot of this just takes a very serious long-term effort to build out basically a lot of these capabilities. Now, what the U.S. government has done is that it has turned a lot of its firms into unreliable suppliers. Out of, I think, highly legitimate security concerns, the U.S. government has said, we don't want Huawei equipment in our networks. But also, it's gone quite a lot further by denying a lot of the critical components, which are mostly made by American companies, to take down Huawei. The U.S. government has really significantly escalated this attack on what I think is China's most important technology company. And so Huawei is now in this position of trying to find alternative suppliers, whether they are in Japan or Korea or Taiwan or Europe. Best of all, they ought to be Chinese. And so a lot of these smaller suppliers that couldn't have the time of day from Huawei are now becoming suppliers to this big company. And I think this is going to play out in a way that, you know, you have a lot of just this very patient funding to bring up a lot of technology companies up to speed onto, you know, the technology leaders. And this is going to play out for a lot of these different technologies, because China is taking this self-sufficiency goal much more seriously now.
You know, something that interests me, and it goes back to one of your first answers, and it's sort of, I'm still scratching my head on this a lot, is, you know, when you were talking about, say, the mask manufacturing in China, one of the reasons that it was successful is the Chinese government established very early on the profit potential, that they were a buyer, that there would be buyers of masks. You could say one of the reasons that the vaccine rollout in the U.S. or the vaccine development happened so fast is Operation Warp Speed, de-risking the process, the government de-risking the process by promising to buy vaccines. And then going back to chips, as you point out, like one of the historical strategies has been the government's going to buy a lot. And then, of course, if you look at the U.S. historical semiconductor industry, you know, came out of DOD buying. So obviously the demand side is a really important part of the equation, whether we're talking about masks, whether we're talking about vaccines, whether we're talking about chips. But it doesn't sound like that's enough. So what more needs to be done beyond just the sort of getting the demand side right to really catalyze the expansion and innovation and develop that know-how?
Well, if you're China, you don't really have to be bound by the demand side. You have the luxury of not having to choose because China doesn't simply manage the demand side. It also encourages a lot of producer side subsidies. China is very much a supply side economy. So the really striking thing to me economically in 2020 was that a lot of Western countries directed a stimulus to basically households in the form of, you know, checks from the government, sort of to stimulate consumption. And if you take a look at China's government spending this year, its fiscal stimulus to households has been absolutely minimal. Its interest rate cuts has been also minimal. And it focused a lot on just getting production back online and then trying to, you know, focus on helping manufacturers get back to their feet. Over the first half of the year, I had basically a lot of conversations about how local governments, as well as the central government, were very intimately involved in basically trying to scale up and to rebuild a lot of these supply chains. And I think that effort has continuously paid off if you take a look at the continued strength of China's exports. Now, China is, you know, again, doesn't have to choose. It is now really intent on doing technology. What it has is a lot of scale in a way that, for example, Denmark does not. You know, China has a very large market to play in. They are able to build very substantial companies, not necessarily leading companies, out of a population of 1.3 billion people. And what's been quite striking to me last year was that seeing how the central party leadership, especially President Xi Jinping, continuously emphasize that China needs to do a lot more technology. So he has continuously said that we need a secure and controllable supply chain. We need to innovate our way out of choke point technologies. The most astonishing government directive I thought of last year was that at the end of the year, folks gather in Beijing for the Central Economic Work Conference, which lists out the economic priorities for the next year. And in 2020, basically in December, the highest economic officials said, our top priority in 2021 will be science and technology. As far as I can tell, science and technology has never been broken out as one of the eight independent items that China will really need to figure out. And to say, you know, and this topped the item for the last major work directive. So this is a pretty big whole of society effort to figure out a lot more technology.
So on that note, how do you see this developing in 2021? Are we going to see a continuation of China's dedication to building out its tech expertise? Or perhaps, you know, we have Joe Biden coming in as the president, a new administration. Perhaps that takes some of the pressure off. Or is this a dynamic that you think is going to be going on for a long time?
I think it's going to go on for a very long time. And I think the Chinese government has realized that it really needs to figure out a lot of the indigenous innovation projects that it has embarked on so that it can't be very easily choked off by capricious foreign governments on critical technologies. At the same time, I don't necessarily think that China will make any immediate breakthroughs in anything like the short term, in anything like the next 2 to 3 years, although there could be, you know, company level breakthroughs on smaller technologies, because the general trend that I see in China is that, you know, things get better, but at a very slow rate. So if you take a look at, you know, the iPhone, the very first iPhone, you know, very famously is assembled in China and designed in California. The first iPhone incorporated something like 2% of Chinese value add in its hardware. And that was basically the value of the labor in China that gathered to really put together this phone components that came from places like the US and Japan and Germany and other places. And now an academic that determined the original 2% figure also did an update of the study in 2018. He took apart an iPhone 10 and then found that the iPhone 10's share of Chinese value added had increased to something like 25%. So you had a growth of 2% to 25% over 10 years of a much higher value phone. And so, you know, that's sort of the paradigmatic story to me of a lot of Chinese progress, you know, innovating on what is one of the hardest electronics products in the world, but at a pretty slow and steady pace, not necessarily in big breakthroughs. I sort of see this Chinese patience sort of, you know, not overrunning the U.S. semiconductor industry any soon, but steadily making better progress.
Why can't China just hire the number two person at Taiwan Semiconductor, who that is, whoever that is? Like, why is it not that easy?
Well, they certainly have spent quite a lot of effort trying to recruit a lot of engineers from especially Taiwan, as well as Korea. I remember staying at a hotel close to a Chinese memory chip plant. Koreans are really dominant in memory. And then the hotel staff told me, well, you know, most of our residents are Korean engineers. They all have their own private drivers, and they get to fly home to Seoul on the weekends. I'm currently sitting in Shanghai, which is the site of China's most advanced semiconductor maker, SMIC. I'm told that SMIC built a church for one of its first executives, which came from TSMC, in fact. And it's built a street called Little Taipei, where you can get really good beef noodles as well as bubble tea. So they constantly make efforts to hire particular people. The issue is that you need to hire not just one person, but you need to hire entire teams and entire, you know, divisions of staff. And you also need the cooperation of all of your suppliers in order to continue innovating here. And that's not really something that Chinese firms have really well established.
So I have a related question, but we've been talking a lot about what China is doing domestically to build up its tech expertise. We haven't been talking a lot about what it's doing externally. Is there any, do you think there's any desire or appetite on the part of China to try to, I guess, complicate other countries' tech ambitions, basically retaliate against the US in the way that the US has imposed restrictions on Chinese tech?
Tracy, one of these the things that we've been thinking about very actively is when Beijing would be ready to retaliate against U.S. firms. And I've been consistently taking the view that China will not broadly retaliate against U.S. firms. And so far, I think my view has generally held up pretty well. Now, every time the U.S. Department of Commerce does something really mean against Huawei, I have a bunch of folks asking me, well, you know, who is Beijing going to punish next? It doesn't really calm minds in the U.S. when Global Times, one of the nationalist state-owned papers, every time lists a list of ABCQ of retaliation, it's going to be Apple, Boeing, Cisco, and Qualcomm that are targets for retaliation. And in fact, we haven't really seen any, you know, highly visible instances of retaliation against U.S. firms. And I think that comes down to a couple of different reasons. And broadly speaking, first of all, China really needs American technology, which is highly evident in Huawei's current struggles because it hasn't been able to get its hands on American semiconductors. So U.S. technology firms are very important in China, and you can't lose them. You also have basically U.S. employers, U.S. companies being major employers in the Chinese market. Apple employs over 1 million people directly through manufacturing and retail in China, through contract manufacturers like Foxconn. You have American companies like General Motors hiring basically tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of people. Even Starbucks and McDonald's were pretty important for urban youth employment, which had been looking even a bit shaky before the pandemic. Now, folks in Beijing used to tell me that, well, a lot of the people who work at Starbucks can just go work for Luckin Coffee instead. But now that we all know that Luckin Coffee is a big fraud, you know, I think folks are not saying that so much anymore. And, you know, I think the other reason that Beijing has mostly been restrained is that it has perceived that the best way to retaliate against American firms is not to play into the hands of hardliners at the White House or National Security Council, who would like nothing better for American companies to pull up their stakes and then move production, if not back to the U.S., then to Vietnam or India or Mexico. It is better to hug them even closer, which is the attitude that has been pretty apparent under President Xi, to really try to engage much more with American businesses who are, after all, effectively lobbying Washington, D.C. in order to preserve access to China, which for so many companies is their fastest growing market or expect to be one of their largest markets in the next couple of years. And broadly, I don't get the sense in Beijing that they are ready to retaliate against any big American company like Apple. Otherwise, a lot of the entire business community might leave, and that's not the outcome that Beijing is ready for yet.
What do you see on the horizon? Uncertainty or opportunity. Whatever you see, at PGIM, we can help you rise to the challenges of today, providing outlooks on the market with deep global and local expertise. With over 1,400 investment professionals in pursuit of long-term returns, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
The fact that, you know, talk about replicating Taiwan semi in China, that China can't even replicate Starbucks, that the homegrown Starbucks alternative turned out to go poof, sort of tells you something. We haven't really talked about Taiwan semi that much on this episode, but of course we've been talking about it a lot on recent episodes. But talk to us about your view of the sort of Chinese government view of the company and how that plays into the broader tension over Taiwan itself.
Right. Well, Joe, one of the frequent questions I get with, Beijing's attitude to TSMC is whether, you know, there might be some sort of a hot conflict or a military conflict with TSMC if Beijing tries to initiate something. Now, I think there might be other reasons to expect that Beijing will have military action, but I'm always very skeptical that Beijing will take military action over Taiwan for this particular reason. And I think the thinking here is that, first of all, technology exists in people's heads. It's not just about the machinery. And if you have basically anything like a nasty conflict over Taiwan, I think you can't guarantee that a lot of critical engineers won't be evacuated ahead of time or will always be perfectly safe during, you know, some sort of hot conflict. Second of all, you know, if you have some sort of, bigger action, some sort of hot conflict, can you really guarantee that these big factories that cost, you know, tens of billions of dollars now really can be, you know, safe from some sort of damage? And I think the most important factor here is that if Beijing ever escalates into, you know, any sort of very violent action against Taiwan, it will be sanctioned by every Western government that provides it the technology that both the Chinese industry as well as TSMC and the Taiwanese industry would need to continue growing. So much of the equipment to make semiconductors comes from the United States, as well as from the Netherlands, as well as from Japan. And I think that China would not be able to get its hands on pretty much so many crucial components past that point, because the foreign governments will just impose a pretty comprehensive embargo or, you know, highly targeted embargo on semiconductors if the situation ever got to that point. So I'm always very skeptical that this would be a particular reason to act.
How long can TSMC maintain its lead in semiconductor manufacturing?
I think that TSMC will have a very substantial lead for a pretty long time. But, you know, I think the comfort for Chinese firms is that, you know, technology might be moving to a point where you don't necessarily always need the cutting edge to, be a very successful firm. Now, if you take a look at what has driven a lot of the technological advancements from, you know, 14 nanometers to 7 nanometers to 5 nanometers to 3 nanometers in semiconductor process nodes has been the sale of smartphones. And smartphones for the last 3 years has been a declining market, which shows that, you know, there isn't necessarily a huge amount of demand at the very top levels of technology beyond basically, you know, certain iPhone, Apple, and Qualcomm processors. you know, if you believe in all of the hype around 5G, and I'm not sure that I do, you know, if we have, semiconductors in every traffic light, if you have semiconductors in, every bookshelf, if I'm having semiconductors in my coffee, basically, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, leading edge semiconductors in a traffic light. A lot of it will be, you know, pretty simple stuff of the type that China can mostly manufacture today. And even if you take a look at the most advanced AI chips, they're not necessarily on the cutting edge of 5 or 3 nanometers. A lot of them are trailing edge chips. If you take a look at the cloud server chips, these are not necessarily, again, 5 or 3. And so I think the case that China can be a little bit happier about is that technology is moving to a point where, you know, the whole thing is maturing, but you may not necessarily need cutting edge and everything for from now on.
Yeah, this was something our last guest talking about this also mentioned. And so essentially, in your view, I mean, we could talk a lot about, you know, you mentioned earlier, TSMC spending $28 billion in CapEx in 1 year. But the risk then is that technological dominance, manufacturing dominance is not the business. It does not necessarily translate into the current into business dominance.
A lot of things are leading edge once and then commoditized, which is where China can catch up, and it's possible that this will also happen to semiconductors.
I want to take a different turn. I mean, so much of this conversation and something we've talked about, and I'm really curious to get your take. I mean, some of this conversation is about, and past chats we've had are about this sort of like scientific communities, network effects of tech hubs, so to speak. And that debate is happening here in the U.S. quite a bit, and you hear a lot of U.S. tech and startup people talking about replicating Silicon Valley elsewhere, whether it's somewhere in Texas or Miami, and you have all these VCs tweeting about how they're going to move. And I know some of the stuff that they're into, as you point out, isn't even really technology, especially if it's just software, internet consumer, or exploiting network effects. It's not really tech per se, but I am curious what you think about like the prospects of new Silicon Valleys opening up somewhere in the U.S., especially planned ones. Oh, we're all going to move to Miami. Like, how are you thinking about some of these questions, future of Silicon Valley, and future of other U.S. tech hubs or elsewhere?
Well, a lot of the thinking about what makes the current Silicon Valley work has always been a bit of a mystery. I used to live in San Francisco. At this point, most of my friends who live in San Francisco are quite keen to leave, not necessarily to Austin or Miami, but people have always dreamt of moving down to Los Angeles because of the housing issue in San Francisco, the higher rate of property crime, the human waste on the streets. It's always been a pretty frustrating place to live in. But on the other hand, it's also where you have fantastic universities doing a lot of cutting edge research. It's where the current nodes in this network are. And maybe, it has a lot to do with weather. So, Miami and Austin in the summer are not necessarily very pleasant places. Maybe, it all comes down to having a cool and pleasant sunny weather. I think whether Miami or Austin really make it really depends on how quickly Silicon Valley in its current form in San Francisco can unravel.
Does it matter that some of this isn't real tech, that a lot of it is not particularly, a lot of the things that people are excited about are not really science-based?
I don't, not necessarily. I think, there is a lot of skills involved in building a really functional app, and a lot of, most other cities, to say nothing of most other countries in the world, have not figured out how to build a really good intuitive app that consumers really love to use. And so there is quite a lot of process knowledge. There's a lot of tacit knowledge that goes into how to create these wonderful products. But I would also say there's a lot of marketing involved in Silicon Valley to really try to have user adoption. Maybe that sort of sales culture pays off a little bit more in Austin or in Miami. But certainly there is still quite a lot of real engineering expertise in building these different software businesses.
What really excites you in tech at the moment?
Semiconductors, Tracy.
Okay, I'll rephrase it. What's the next big thing in semiconductors?
And what are we going to be talking to you about in January of 2022?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think there is a lot of very exciting things going on now, actually, outside of semiconductors. Tyler Cowen, who's a Bloomberg columnist, has speculated that maybe the Great Stagnation processes outlined as, you know, broadly technological stagnation over the last few years may be ending. And so he's excited about things like the mRNA vaccine being developed in record time, the space launches from SpaceX. A lot of things have gone very quickly in the U.S. In science, and so I'm excited about those things too. And it's possible that the Chinese now have some form of a proven quantum computing supremacy, and not something I really understand about. There's also a claim that they figured out some aspect of nuclear fusion here. But I encourage you to look at Tyler Cowen's work and then see, you know, maybe we can chat about those topics in a follow-up episode.
You know, I realize there's all kinds of, when you mentioned that, there's all kinds of follow-up questions. Like, we could also talk about your view on automotive tech and so forth. One quick thing before we go that I realize is kind of big, and we haven't really talked about, TikTok was a huge thing. It was kind of one of the tech stories of 2020. And it seemed like the first real, like, Chinese consumer app that took the world by storm and stands toe-to-toe with the consumer apps like Facebook and other stuff. Is that, how big of a deal is that? And what does that tell you about a sort of a Chinese consumer internet company being able to play on the global scale in a way I don't think we've really seen before?
I think TikTok is a highly innovative company that's done a lot of great things, and I'm not sure if China will be able to replicate that success anytime soon. Now, if you take a look at the essays in particular of Eugene Wei, he's really analyzed a lot of the factors of TikTok's success, including by trying to grab a lot of users and then figuring out the right algorithms to recommend the next videos. Certainly, there's been a huge amount of consumer internet innovation there. Now, the question for me that's quite interesting with TikTok for China is that if TikTok will be the start of a trend of just basically marvelous Chinese cultural creations that, you know, a lot of folks really want to use around the world, like TikTok, or whether it's more of an exception that was able to escape the system in a way that China has not produced very compelling cultural products over the last 4 years, outside of a few, you know, art house movies, outside of, the Three Body Problem, which is still, again, kind of a niche product. And I'm not sure that there has been many cultural Chinese successes. And I'm sort of leaning towards the way that TikTok was something that was able to escape a censorious and repressive system instead of, the start of a great big trend of Chinese cultural outpouring. And just to note that Pew surveys of China over the last year has really spiked sharply negative in pretty much all Western countries, including the U.S., when you have basically a lot of comments from senior U.S. officials now designating China as a strategic competitor, when you have basically a lot of Western countries closing their markets off to Chinese firms, which deprives them of a lot of the richest and most discerning customers in the world. I think the prospects for generating a splendid Chinese success, I would say, are not very high. But let's see how the next decade plays out.
We'll have to have you on again in a decade.
Wonderful.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, that was great. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you, and that was it's a treat.
Great. Well, thank you very much again for the invitation.
Tracy, all I'll say is there's a reason why I think Dan is one of the most requested guests that we have on the show.
I think there's two reasons. So I think one is that he does come up with very original ideas. So his idea about why can't China be cool is something that I don't think a lot of people necessarily think about. But when it comes to consumer tech, coolness is sort of wrapped up in it, right? People want a certain smartphone, or they want a certain product because it's kind of cool. And then the second thing about Dan, of course, is that he just explains everything very, very clearly.
you know, sometimes like we wrap things up and it's like a summary of what they said, but it's like Dan is so clear. I feel like I don't have anything to add. Like, is it the way he describes the different dynamics going on in different industries? It's like, I feel like I learned so much. So I don't even have that much to say.
No, neither do I. I feel like with Dan, the only thing you can kind of do is just keep asking him about different topics. Like, just tell me your thoughts on this and then this and this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like at the end, I was like, well, we should do get his take on automotive tech and we should get his take on space tech and all kinds of stuff like that, because I could have just listened to him for a lot longer. But I don't have anything to add to Dan.
Well, don't worry, Joe. We will have him on again next year and probably in 10 years as well.
Great.
Okay. Shall we leave it there?
Yep.
This has been another episode of the Odd Thoughts podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway. You can follow me on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Weisenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart. Definitely follow our guest, Dan Wong. He's at Dan W. Wong. Also, check out his website, danwong.co. He writes a really great annual essay about all the things and books he read in the last year. This one's the one for 2020 is really spectacular. So check it out. Follow our producer, Laura Carlson. She's at Laura M. Carlson. Follow the Bloomberg head of podcast, Francesca Levy, at Francesca Today. And check out all of our podcasts at Bloomberg under the handle at Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.